Logos appear on a black background, white capital letters with a blue underline. Kino Lorber. A lens glides over a white background. Letters in orange and blue appear. A sky original. White shapes slide and stretch on a black background. White letters appear. Topic. Dark letters A and P before a light brown letter X. Made in association with Apex Content Ventures. Now yellow text on a black background. Sky presents. A Mindhouse production in association with Sky Studios and Topic. An illustration of a girl falling into a hole. Above her, a rabbit holds a pocket watch and a cat smiles widely. A white short-haired woman speaks to us.
In the beginning, when I was first convicted, I felt like Alice in Wonderland. Down the rabbit hole in this strange place that doesn't follow any rules that I'm used to or anything like that.
Text, the extraordinary trial captivating America. Photos of the woman escorted by the police out of a courtroom.
When I came out, I remember I went to my hairstylist and I just gave a big sigh and I said, okay, you're going to be my first experience with experimenting with how much I say or don't say about where I've been the past couple years and where I've been as I was in prison.
Text. Who is the victim in the Anna Stubblefield case? Controversial communication method. The activist professor who sacrificed her family, career, and eventually her freedom.
My inclination, here I am sitting here doing this, is, I don't mind people knowing because, I'm not guilty of a crime, so.
Highlighted text from an article. My actions were motivated by love. Now a small portable keyboard with an LED display is placed on a table. A black man slowly and effortfully types on the keyboard with his index finger. Text in a digital font appears on the screen while being typed. I am confined without the ability to speak. The keyboard is marked as an evidence. A brunette white woman confidently walks in the hallway of a building. The door of Dr. Anna Stubblefield's office. Framed photos of a black man hang on a wall. The black man types on the keyboard while the white woman holds his elbow. Text in a digital font. Anna changed my life. She is the person who understands me. The white woman holds the black man's hand, which rests on the table. More text in a digital font appears. The words blur out as the title slowly appears in the center. Tell them you love me. Yellow text on black background. Chapter 1. Communication. In an office in August 2011, a man in a suit and tie talks with a black woman.
We are in the Special Victims Unit of the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, also home of the Child Advocacy Center. We're here today because there was a innocent that was reported to the Rutgers Police Department regarding your son, Derek.
Yes.
Derek's mother nods.
Does Derek have any mental or physical impairments that he would need help? He doesn't have the faculties to make decisions on his own.
No.
Now, did you reach that conclusion on your own, or did someone evaluate him at some point?
Well,
Derek's mother slowly smiles.
From birth, I knew there was something wrong.
A row of houses in Irvington, New Jersey. Derek's mother.
Derek,
black man, Derek Johnson, sleeps soundly in his bed. He lies sideways with his arms folded under his chest.
Are you ready to get up?
Derek's mother stares at him. Derek raises his head and wakes up. He groans. Derek slowly rubs his eyes with his hands.
Come on.
Derek slowly sits up and gives a big wide yawn. John Johnson, a black man with long dread, speaks to us.
I remember when they brought Derek home from the hospital, and I was just disappointed. I was like, I got a baby brother? I wanted a little sister.
A photo of an infant Derek sleeping in a crib.
And then when they brought him in the house and I saw him, it was like an instant connection. Everything was fine. Nothing out of the ordinary.
A photo of young John beside an infant Derek.
I just remember that at a certain point he became very listless. He didn't move much.
John and Derek's mother, Daisy Johnson, speaks to us.
He wouldn't wake up. He slept all the time. He wasn't doing what he was supposed to do. Like, he wasn't sucking. He wasn't holding his bottle. And he couldn't hold his head. I would ask the doctor, well, what's wrong with Derek? And he said, oh, you're comparing him to your oldest son. He'll be all right. And I says, no, something's not right.
A photo of Daisy holding an infant Derek in her arms. John.
Early on, Derek had a series of seizures.
A shaky and confused view of a crib mobile and a woman praying, Daisy.
So then they took Derek, they put him in a sound room. And they would do the lights for his eyes to follow, and he just wouldn't react or couldn't. And that's when they told me that he had cerebral palsy. Mm-hmm. And he would never, you know, be able to do as normal children would do.
Mm-hmm. A child study team evaluation report.
Derek visited a few psychologists. They deemed him, as the term they used, mentally retarded, nonverbal, with cerebral palsy. You know, then not knowing what the heck that meant, it just meant that Derek can't walk, Derek can't talk.
Daisy spoon feeds Derek. Her eyes widen as she watches Derek gulp the food.
It's all gone. It
does. Derek tilts his head backward and stiffly looks around. In the prosecutor's office, Daisy talks to the detective.
I raised my two sons alone. Their father, after Derek was born, he took the high road. He walked.
And left you guys alone?
And left us alone.
Back at home, Derek points to his ear.
Take your hands out to your ears. What you want? What's the problem? Hmm?
Detective.
So let me ask you some questions. Derek is nonverbal.
Yes.
Is that the term? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What does that necessarily mean?
He talks like if he's hungry, he'll hit the table or a wall or whatever and say, eat, eat. If he gets really excitable, then maybe he will mumble the word ma or ya, but he more or less communicate with his eyes or his hands.
Daisy watches Derek drink from a glass.
You know the routine. One finger. What's that? You signing me?
Derek holds the glass with his index fingers raised. He looks one way and then the other. He gently wriggles his fingers. A baby photo of Derek. His fingers on one hand bend and curl like a thumbs up sign, while his head bends sideways. John.
Eventually, the seizures started to subside. But what his cognitive level was, I didn't have a way of assessing that. I know that he was listless for a point in time, and then all of a sudden there was an awakening of sorts where he was in the world.
A photo of a young Derek playing in a ball pool, then a portrait of a grown-up Derek.
Whenever we would lock eyes, like, there was recognition there. I just began to see Derek, you know, develop his own personality and kind of come into his own.
Oh, they were inseparable. Derek would come home after school. John would run home, meet Derek bus, get Derek in the house, call me. Mom, we in the house.
At a certain point, I just threw him on my back. Play together, get into mischief together. You know, wherever I go, Derek has to go.
Photos of Derek with a disabled black woman in a wheelchair. They both wear formal attire.
Derek's a character. You know, he loves to give hugs. He just loves to smile a lot. You know, you know when he's happy. He used to do, we called it the Stevie Wonder Dance. You know, when Stevie Wonder's playing on the piano and really feeling the music, and his head would sway side to side. And so Derek would do that from time to time, too, especially in church when he's, like, really feeling the music.
John groovily sways his head side to side and hums. A photo of Derek with people in church. More photos of Derek in formal attire.
Sometimes he's self-abusive. We can be somewhere, and then all of a sudden, put his hand in his mouth and start banging his head and his knee. And I don't know why. Maybe he's frustrated, but he can't communicate. So what is going on in your head, Derek? Like, to me, that was the great mystery.
In a photo, Derek calmly looks up at us with his head slightly tilted backward. His lips are apart, showing his teeth. Now a water sprinkler abundantly showers a front lawn. Text, West Orange, New Jersey. A black car rushes past a one-story house with a green front lawn. Inside, the white woman with short hair named Anna Stubblefield talks to us in an interview.
Tell me the story of how you met.
Anna looks downward and thinks.
I'm pretty sure, or at least I'm hopeful, that I haven't
been rewriting things in my head. I didn't want to do that. I see how easily it can happen.
A video footage from 2009. In an auditorium, Anna sits down in a panel. Her laptop lies on the table in front of her. A man speaks.
Our next speaker is Anna Stubblefield, the director of the philosophy department at Rutgers.
Anna pulls a microphone closer to her and speaks.
How's this one? That's better. Okay. I was teaching in the American Studies doctoral program at Rutgers Newark. Race, class, gender and sexual orientation, and disability are inextricably intertwined, such that none of these concepts would exist as it does without the others. And John was one of my students.
A photo of John in class.
When I was doing my PhD at Rutgers,
when a person cannot understand,
Anna Stubblefield was a philosopher of race.
An article by Anna.
And also had a class about disability studies.
Alongside theorizing about disability and ethics, I also provide support to people labeled with developmental disabilities. I work with people who cannot communicate vocally to provide them with access to alternative forms of verbal expression and to literacy.
You know, while I grew up with a disabled brother, I was not familiar with disability studies, and I think as an instructor, she was great. And as a scholar, she was great as well.
A white woman puts on her eyeglasses while she walks in a hallway.
The course was looking at the notion of intelligence as a concept.
The white woman writes on a blackboard.
For example, the notion that if somebody can't speak, it must be because they're too stupid and there's just nothing in their head. That just is not the case. It's not the case. Lacking speech doesn't mean that you don't have anything to say. It doesn't mean that you can't use language if somebody can just get you access to a way to do it.
A video is projected on screen.
Can you describe what your world was like before you were able to communicate?
A documentary. A woman named Sue Rubin listlessly stares. Her tongue touches her upper lip.
Can you describe that for me?
Sue blinks and remains silent. John talks to us.
Somewhere along the course, we ended up watching his video.
Banna.
The person that was in the video had autism.
You want to go to grandma's? Yeah, grandma is going to come here.
Sue Rubin. She's somebody who's perceived by her parents and everybody as severely intellectually impaired and just not there.
Sue screams and struggles as she and an older woman exit a door.
But then she's given access to a way to communicate.
When I was 13, my mother said that she had seen someone start to communicate using a keyboard in support. It's called facilitated communication. As I began to type, my mind began to wake up.
Sue grabs the keyboard from the older woman.
The person that was in the video used a keyboard and eventually became proficient enough to communicate the complexities of her life.
She was able to do college-level work, and she graduated with a dual major, et cetera, et cetera. And this was her story.
A woman reads while Sue types.
I think I was lost, W-A, in some way. I acted like my worst nightmare, Y-E-S.
Sue grabs the keyboard and gives the woman a fist bump.
At that time, I had never heard anything about this facilitated communication.
The white woman stands in an empty classroom. A black male student enters and approaches her, Anna.
After that class, John, he said, this woman in this film reminds me a lot of my brother. How she moves, how she looks, and then I see her typing and she's going to college, and we've always been told that my brother, you know, basically he should be institutionalized, but we've always felt that maybe there's something more going on
there. A photo
of
John, Derek, and Daisy. John.
We recognize that Derek had a disability, but we never thought that he was incapable of doing any number of things. I always knew that there was something there. Like, right on cue, at certain points, Derek would say, you know, Derek was paying attention. Derek wanted to weigh in on this discussion. When we would go to get haircuts, I would sit there and read the Daily News, and Derek would be sitting next to me. And so every so often, Derek would look over my shoulder and look in the newspaper. And was it a mimicking behavior? Maybe. But he has this way of appearing to be absorbing information. And so there were dozens of these kinds of moments through our lifetime.
Derek sits in his room. A video plays on a laptop in front of him.
I love my brother to death. And I always want nothing but the best for him. And so I asked her, I would love to hear more about facilitated communication. Who can I talk to?
The black male student talks to the white woman in the classroom.
I told them the nearest place on the East Coast where their support for facilitated communication is Syracuse University, but it's going to be too expensive. So I said to John, if you wanted, I could at least just kind of do some initial stuff, kind of see if it's working.
The white woman walks in a hallway. Then she enters a room, Dr. Anna's office. Daisy talks to us.
She was Miss Anna. You know, she could do great things. She was gonna move mountains, and I accepted her at her word.
A sunny day, a one-story white house in a quiet neighborhood in Berkeley, California. A middle-aged white woman with long gray curly hair walks into the kitchen. She sits on a chair. Then she smiles and talks to us.
I'm in the podcast.
I'm Deva Kasnitz. I'm an anthropologist.
I have specialized in the ethnography of this.
In the ethnography of disability. I have torsion dystonia. The dystonia creates
involuntary
movements. I've had times when I almost could not walk.
However, the most disabling
Is by far the speech.
Without
communication, you can't do anything else. I met Anna Stubblefield
in my role. In the
Society for Disability Studies.
And it's interesting. Better than average at listening.
She is better than average at listening.
She is able to look at me.
She's able to look at me.
Drain all of her.
Drain out her brain.
All of the things that she said.
All of the things that she thinks I'm gonna say.
And just listens.
And just listens.
To what I do
say. To what I do say.
Anna is just stunning at it.
Photos of young Anna. Anna speaks to us.
When I was a child, I came from an unusual family. My mom did work with people with a range of physical disabilities, people with intellectual disabilities who came to the house. My mom had a t-shirt with the slogan, "Labels are for jars, not people." I found disability interesting because of that exposure. And so I got my dad to build me a pair of crutches so I could, pretend to be post-polio or have cerebral palsy or something like that. I'd, tie a blindfold on and spend all afternoon.
Anna's mother, Sandy McLennan.
During her elementary years, I taught her how to write Braille. At her request, I got her a blind pen pal. She was interested in sign language, and I think she may have learned some of that.
Anna.
I was fascinated by the way in which it's not really the impairment, it's the environment that creates impairments for people. Growing up, I got that message very powerfully. How in our society, it's like we want everybody to walk through the same size door. And if you don't fit in that door, there's something wrong with you. And that doesn't have to be that.
An auditorium full of people. A woman in a wheelchair carefully wheels herself into the front row. A man speaks.
Facilitated Communication in Syracuse, sponsored by the Facilitated Communication Institute at Syracuse University.
Sandy.
I learned about facilitated communication in December of 1990 at a conference.
A photo of a woman with a rectangular face and bobbed hair.
Rosemary Crossley reported on the work she'd done in Australia.
An elderly white woman, Rosemary Crossley, talks to us.
I had done some work with a girl named Anne McDonald who had ethetoid cerebral palsy. Couldn't move her hands, couldn't speak. There was nothing. We had a spelling board, but because she had cerebral palsy, her hands would move so much that she couldn't actually hit a target. I tried what would happen if I supported her under her upper arm. She could then move from the elbow and do better in selecting items.
A photo of Rosemary and Anne McDonald.
And it turned out that she could spell. She was very smart. We gave her the page turner so that every time she hit a button, the page would turn. And suddenly she could read books.
A photo of Anne smiling widely. Sandy.
As soon as I heard their presentation, I knew that's what I needed. This is how to help all these kids who I used to work with.
Disabled people type on keyboards while another person holds their elbow, wrist, or clothes. Anna.
My mother's one of the first people in the country who started doing training workshops and facilitated communication. When she came back and started using it, she was videotaping everybody, and I ended up being the one who ran the camera. So I was there when she first started using it. I was part of that moment.
Text typed on screen. I am no longer in a world of silence. Thank you for giving me a voice.
To see people for the first time, be able to type out something. Being part of that was, it was amazing.
Video footage.
We find that once we open this world for the kids, they are social now, they are appropriate, they do have language, they do understand.
I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Charisse has typed 120 poems, 9 short stories. She talks about everything she feels.
More disabled people type on keyboards. Sandy.
We understood that people knew what it was they wanted to communicate, and we needed to just provide some means to make that possible physically.
Yellow text on black background. March 2009. A tree outside a building sways gently in the soft breeze on a sunny day. Anna.
When I met Derek, I'd been told he had cerebral palsy, and that was all. He walks, he needs to hold on to somebody's arm, have a little support. He can focus his gaze, but his eyes kind of go off, his head turns. If you're not used to that, we see that as signs of lack of intelligence. I've seen enough people like that in my life to know that that's simply not true, so I don't register things that way.
The white woman cuts out a picture from a magazine.
So I had just cut out some pictures from magazines or drawn some pictures. John and Daisy were in the room watching, and I said to Derek, I'm going to ask you some questions, and I'm not asking them because I don't think you're smart enough or anything. I just want to see what happens when you try to point to something.
The black man hovers his index finger above the cutout pictures.
So I watched, and he would kind of start moving his arm. It would go a little ways, and then he'd have this kind of muscle jerk reaction, which turned out to be very typical. You can see how hard he works to try to have the least little bit of control over his arm, and it's slow. If you've got cerebral palsy, you might be able to get your hand to something you're pointing at, but it might take you a minute. How do you have a conversation like that?
The white woman holds the black man's elbow.
So I had started with just a little support on his elbow, and that was it initially. That freed him up enough, and then he could select which picture he wanted.
The black man points to a picture of President Barack Obama. Then he touches a picture of a telephone.
So far, so good.
The white woman writes 4 letters on separate pieces of paper.
Then I said, now what I want to do is see where you're at with literacy. So I had cards that just had letters on them, kind of like doing Boggle. So if you have A, B, C, and T. You can spell cat, you can spell bat. And when I asked him to spell as many words as he could using these four letters, he made a very good showing with that.
The black man thoughtfully touches the letters one by one.
But it's one thing to reach your whole hand toward a very large target. It's an entirely different thing to get one finger pushing a
keyboard. Now a small keyboard.
So I had this small, very lightweight portable keyboard with a small LED display called the Neo. I ended up where I was keeping his fingers folded down so that his index finger was isolated.
Capital letter I blinks on the LED display.
And the first thing I asked him to do was point to the letter H, the letter T, and he started making mistakes. So he mixed up the A and the H, and he mixed up the T and the F and the U and the V. What I realized was that the alphabetical order or letter board that I'd set up were all lowercase letters, and on the Neo is capital letters, and so the difference between the A and the H was one little line across the top of the A, that sort of thing. When he was making those mistakes, I just said, no, you're wrong. You know, I asked for the A, you hit the H, here's the A here, and then I went through some other letters, and then I would go back. He didn't make the same mistake twice.
The brown-skinned hand slowly types the letter H on the Neo.
So he was a really fast learner. Tell him once, he's got it.
Now he presses the letter D, then M, Daisy.
It was like the porch lights went on, and I was like, wow, is he doing it? And I felt very excited about it.
Photos of Daisy smiling beside Derek.
She said, don't forget, you're traveling with him. You're taking him places. And when you're taking him, he's reading the signs. And, you know, I'm all...
Daisy gives a sly smile.
Tell me what my sons can do.
She shakes her head skeptically. Now a photo of John smiling as he fixes Derek's coat. John.
I was elated. I mean, I always knew that there was something there. And so, in a way, it somewhat confirmed what I'd already knew. In the school that he attended, the Estes County Day Training Program, they had done some remarkable things with...
Photos of Derek in his wheelchair at school.
They were able to get him to the point where he can, you know, walk on his own. But there was this question of intellectual capacity. And so to have this revelation that Derek can do these things, it was just like, wow. I knew it was there, and I'm just happy.
Video file of Daisy's interview with the detective.
To see him do that, I was very excited, you know. And I'll never forget, she asked him, she said, well, who's the president? And he touched Obama. And I was like, wow, you know, he's...
He was progressing.
A sunny day, trees ablaze with light-colored leaves surround a campus building. Text, fall 2009. Anna talks to us.
One day when Derek came and I just asked him, you know, did you do anything particularly interesting this week? And he typed GM.
The white woman supports the black man's hand.
His spelling was very, very creative in the beginning. And I said, you know, did you play a game? Was there some kind of game? No. Gym. Did you go to the gym? Yes. And then Daisy popped in with, his day program had gone to a health club and he had walked on a treadmill and he'd really enjoyed that.
The man rocks back and forth.
At that point, Daisy had stepped outside the room. And I said, you know what, it's occurring to me that I never actually asked you what you like to be called. Your brother told me your name was Derek and you came in and I've been calling you Derek. Tell me, what do you want me to call you?
The letter I appears on the LED display.
And he typed D-M-A-N.
On the Neo keyboard.
I was looking at that, and it didn't look like any name that I recognized. Daisy came back in the room at that point, and I said, and he typed D-M-A-N. Does that mean anything to you? She said, oh, he had this really great teacher back when he was about 13 years old who used to call him D-Man. That was the teacher who got him out of the wheelchair and got him walking. So I said, is she right? And he said, yes.
Y appears on the LED display.
So I called him Demand from there.
A photo of Demand on a porch swing.
That was a really important moment. Being able to tell people what you want to be called is this important emotional aspect of life that we take away from people when they can't speak.
Fade to black. A portable Neo keyboard. Text. Everything typed on the Neo was saved in its memory. A photo of a tote bag, a Neo, an acrylic stand, and a charging cable with the number one evidence tag. Text. All the writing reproduced in this film is from those records. The white woman and the black man inside the library.
The man and I saw each other several hours a week.
She studies the man's hand.
And over the course of the year, as he speeded up, as his spelling got a little better.
Do you want the letters larger?
It went from a couple word answers.
N. Who do you want to type with? J.
To five word answers.
Looking keyboard is hoping help.
To a whole sentence, to a couple sentences.
Jumping for joy because very happy.
So by the end of a year, we could really have a decent conversation.
I'm happy to see you.
And he could then be more expressive and more detailed about what he had to say. And that was real progress. That's huge.
Please understand that I know you are proud of me, but I prefer not being looked at like a much improved model.
I didn't really feel like I was getting to know him as a person until he got to that stage.
Now a wooden leaf-shaped pendulum continuously swings back and forth. A silhouette of the black man. He sits at the dining table, head banging and hands flapping. John talks to us.
Somewhat early on, Adam started saying Derek had the intellectual capacity to do high-level work and to put sentences together and do all these different things. I was like, whoa, this is great. She told us, because Derek was hanging around you all for so long and listened to your conversations, and you went to movies, and you would watch TV, and so he's absorbing all of these things. And so that's how he built his body of knowledge. And, you know, without, you know, going through a peer-reviewed assessment of those assertions, I was like, okay, I buy that. Cool.
Scattered dried leaves on the campus grounds. Text, fall 2010. Anna.
One of the things that really bothered him was that he hadn't had the opportunity to get a formal education of any sort. His brother was getting a doctoral degree, so he had watched his brother in the whole process, and he really, really, really wanted to have that also.
Students trickle into the classroom.
So there was a course being offered on Saturday mornings at Rutgers Newark that was an African-American literature course, and that looked really interesting to him.
Typing, I lick the idea of African-Ameri. I'm hoping not Popple dug me by how I look. John.
I guess the idea was for Derek to go to a class, possibly write papers, or at least be able to show the work that may put him in line to then go on and pursue a BA. I was getting towards the end of my PhD program, and so, you know, this kind of thing, you know, black scholar, my baby brother who was developmentally disabled was going to be a black, could be a black scholar. I felt great.
Typing. My name is Demand Johnson. I'm not retarded.
I sat in the class with him and provided communication support for class.
Typing continues. I'm just a little different. My facilitator is Professor Stubblefield. I am typing, but just need help keeping my hand steady.
We ended up finding him a student who would facilitate Demand for doing part of the homework. Her name was Sharonda Jones. Sharonda met with him outside of class for several hours a week so he could read the book and then at least take a crack at writing the essay.
A woman with black curly hair.
She had never taken this class. She never read the books. She just provided the support.
An email reads, from Sharonda, subject first assignment, date September 12th, 2010. Hi, Anna. I think we accomplished a significant amount today. He was able to type around 315 words today. Another email reads, he finished all of his reading. I believe that he now ahead of everyone else with his readings.
He wasn't doing 400-level writing, but he was correctly identifying characters and plot elements. He clearly had read the book and understood the book.
Text, Demand Johnson. Assignment number 3, Harriet Jacobs. The girl in the book is not allowed to leave because she is a slave. I believe that I am facing the same thing with my body. I am confined in my life. I live in a body that is not able to move the way that I would like. I live in it because it is what I was given. Now a television plays in class.
One day in class, the professor started it out by showing a film on the entire African diaspora.
Illustrations of captured and bought African slaves.
And Demand wrote something.
I got lots of new ideas, like looking like people are bringing sieve instead of war.
He wasn't expressing himself as articulately as I knew he was capable of. And I was typing back to him because we were in class. So I typed back. What if you said it this way? Wouldn't this be better?
The myth that people are bringing sieve instead of war?
And he typed, I know what you're saying, but just read it the way I wrote it. And I said, okay, fair enough. And then we got called on right at that point.
The white woman raises her hand in class.
I couldn't resist
I was sort of editing slightly as I read, which all it did was make it worse. Screwed up the whole thing. But I got to the end and the discussion went on. He typed, "Never, ever, 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 ever do that again." I can tell Demand mad. This was Demand furious. And I typed back, "I'm so sorry." And he said, "I'm not mad, but don't ever do that again." Because, you know, I did speak for him and that was wrong. Needless to say, I never did it before and I never did it since, but he was pissed.
Anna nods her head, now a shrub with lance-shaped leaves and clusters of small pink flowers. Inside a tiny kitchen with a big window and hanging plant pots. Text, Deva Kasnitz. Water runs from the sink faucet. Deva grabs a mug and fills it. She turns off the faucet and picks up her toothbrush. With both hands, she effortfully brings the mug to her mouth and gargles. Deva talks to us, part of the privilege of my education has been to embrace self-knowledge
and to try my
try to teach my students to do the same.
To demand space
and time.
To show who we are. It takes me 3 times as long
to say a sentence.
I damn well better have something to say.
That's what Anna wanted
for Derek.
A sense of personal power. Fade to black. Text. Chapter 2. Power. The white woman steers the driving wheel and pulls over. She reaches for her white tote bag and exits her car. Now a man vacuums the floor of an empty hall. Rows of chairs are neatly lined up. Anna.
About a year after Demand started typing, my mother was organizing this panel with other FC users for the Society for Disability Studies conference, and she asked if he wanted to be part of the panel.
A disability conference display stand, a microphone, Rosemary.
I like to arrange at conferences that people with disabilities can actually do some presenting.
Attendees start to arrive one by one. John talks to us.
What I had noticed was that in terms of the FC community, Derek was the only African American. I saw this as a very white space, and in a way, Derek was a path breaker, a trailblazer, the Jackie Robinson of FC.
The white woman and the black man sit together. Anna.
The panel was on the right to communication clause in the UN Convention on Disability Rights. But I said to him, don't worry about the official topic of the panel, just write something about the right to communicate or what it means to you to be able to communicate.
The white woman holds the book for the black man.
He wanted to be able to refer to some of the literature. I was getting books for him, Steven Pinker, a neurologist who's written about language being very hardwired. I got him some Piaget. It wasn't much, but it was to give him a taste.
She flips the page.
So he was reading the books. We were talking about things, what he wrote for the panel was very impressive to me. It was less than a page, but he had a choice of words, a way of phrasing things. It really struck me.
Text, the hopeful joy of communication. No punishment is worse than silence. You break out from the silence by giving voice to your intelligence.
I just became more and more aware that, you know, this was a man who was very insightful and very thoughtful.
I'm like my own private citizen.
He spent a lot of time sitting around and he was sitting around thinking and give him some ideas and something to work with. And he was just digging in and seeing stuff. That is what that's what I like in my friends. That's honestly what I like in men.
A photo of Anna fondly watching as Demand presses the Neo.
You know, I'm the kind of nerdy intellectual girl who wants a nerdy intellectual guy.
In the photo, Anna wears eyeglasses and has her brown hair tied back.
You know, you find you really enjoy talking to them, and you know, you share tastes, but you also disagree on things, but you learn from it. I mean, we were just having those kinds of experiences.
A photo of a younger Anna with her black husband.
You know, I was married. My marriage wasn't terrific, but I wasn't in any way thinking about going outside the relationship. I wasn't shopping around. It was nothing like that. At the time, if you'd asked me, you know, how do you feel about Demand? It's, you know, he's my friend.
Text, April 6, 2011. John Johnson Jr. wrote, "Thank you for all your work with my brother Derek." From Anna to John. "Over the past 2 years, Demand has become one of my very best friends, so I can never thank you enough for introducing me to him." Anna.
"I just really, really liked him, and I really, really enjoyed his company, and I was really impressed by him."
A pathway flanked by rows of short but leafy trees. Text, Spring 2011. "The branches of the trees reach out, forming a canopy that arches gracefully overhead. Just across stands the campus building. As a woman walks along the shaded path, the shadows of the trees dance gently in the wind." Anna.
"In March of 2011, I invited the man to speak to an undergraduate class where we were talking about disability issues. So students were asking him questions, and somebody asked him about, you know, what his hopes and dreams were, and he talked about going to college and maybe being a writer someday, which was kind of where he was heading. And then somebody else in the class said to him, you know, what about love? What about relationships? Is that something that you hope for?" And he typed, "I want that more than anything, but that doesn't happen for people with disabilities like mine."
Typing, "I would love to be married, but it seems unlikely."
And in that moment, I mean, what I wanted to say was, I almost, you can have that with me.
The white woman sits alone at her office desk. Her shoulders rise as she lets out a heavy sigh. Her head bows down.
I started thinking about, okay, well, wow, if this is the way I'm feeling, okay, I've got to think about this. And I still didn't want to say anything to him. I was like, well, okay, I've got to figure this out. I mean, I had my husband and my kids.
A photo of Anna with her husband and their two boys.
I'm in love with Demand. I realize this now, but I'm not going to say anything. I have to sort all of this out. It was awkward.
The leaves rustle slowly with the breeze.
Then I saw him about a week later. And I found myself saying, I help the other people that I do facilitated communication with because I just believe so strongly that everyone has a right to communication. And but I said, I do what I do for you because I love you.
The black man's fingers tremor.
And he said, "I know. I love you too."
The white woman raises his hand up.
And I said, "I know."
His fingers shudder as he types.
He asked me to kiss him, and I did. And then he said, "Kiss me again," and I did. And he said, "So now what?"
The white woman continues to facilitate the black man as he types on the Neo. Now a sunny day. Different kinds of vehicles navigate a two-way highway. Rows of houses stand stoically on the bustling roadside. A woman with short hair drives her car. A hanging cross swings gently in front of her. John talks to us.
As things went along, Derek started going on the speaking circuit, I guess, going to these conferences and all, and there started to be some tension.
The black man sits in the back seat. The white woman occupies the passenger seat beside the driver.
They were driving to this event in suburban Trend somewhere, and my mom was playing gospel music, and Anna goes and turns the station.
The white woman reaches over and presses the car radio's button.
And puts on classical music. Derek doesn't want to hear this. He wants to hear
Daisy.
That.
She had ejected my gospel music, so I hit it and it went back.
The woman with short hair presses the car radio's button.
Derek loves gospel. He goes to church. He uses
the black man grasps his hand.
That assumption that he prefers the high culture of classical music and not the low culture of gospel. I mean, it was just too much of a leap.
A row of identical two-story houses with lots of windows. Now inside, Daisy scoops food and spoon-feeds Derek. He gently chews his food and looks away. Daisy.
There were different things that one day, when we broke for lunch, I was cutting up his chicken, and she rolled over to the table and said, "What are you doing giving him meat? He's a vegetarian." I said,
Nobody sent me any friggin' memo.
Daisy's eyes widen. John.
There was another time she's working with Derek on the computer. I said something to the effect of Derek, just joking, like, I can't wait till we get home so we can just get a beer and kick back and just relax. And then on the keyboard, said something to the effect of, well, I don't like beer, I like red wine. And I just thought that to be hella peculiar. Derek does not, he doesn't even like communion wine.
A photo of John and Derek. Now in the shower, Daisy washes Derek's head. Anna talks to us.
If you're in a giving care frame of mind, you don't see the person you're supporting as somebody who's in a position to make their own decisions, who has their own ideas about how they want things done.
Daisy dries Derek's face with tissue paper. Now Derek releases his grip on the wall and waddles toward Daisy.
You want to give them some control to develop into a person who has a good sense of themselves.
Come on.
So that part is a hard adjustment for parents or teachers who've been in a I'm taking care of you mode.
Turn your feet, turn your body, let's step off.
Daisy to the detective.
When I would dress him, you know, and she would pick him up, she had these signs that she would do if he wanted yes or no. And she would say, do you want to wear your undershirt today?
Daisy looks at her palm.
And then if he hit here, that's no, and that was yes.
She points to her thumb.
And
then touches her pointing finger.
Then she went, oh, he don't want to wear this. And that's when she said, you know, you have to understand, you know, you're treating him like he's a kid, he's a man.
Daisy gives the detective a skeptical stare. John.
My mom kept telling me all, you know, Anna was saying that, you know, she's too mothering, she's smothering Derek. Derek doesn't want all of this help from her, that, she, you know, you can't be my mom all the time, and all these different things that it seemed to be breaking my mom down. And then to add to that, this idea that, oh, Derek now wants to live independently.
Anna.
The man had wanted to look into a more independent living arrangement, moving out of his mother's house and moving into a supported living situation.
Typing. Mom still treats me like a kid. I know I will need support my whole life, but I do not feel like a burden. I would be living on my own, going to college, being a writer. I am intelligent. I need to have mom let me leave home. I need to hire my own staff. Into college. Plum pissed off. John.
There was an organization that was able to provide supervised housing for Derek. Derek would have individuals looking out for him 24 hours a day. He would take classes. He would get his degree. As my mom was telling me this, I thought, where's this money going to come from for this? Because it's not going to be free. And I just kind of saw that as, all right, you're getting a little too personal here. Now you're looking into Derek's support, and I just wasn't comfortable with that.
Daisy.
I said, Anna, if he's going to move in a place, he's going to move in the basement where John lived before John got on his own. Derek is not going anywhere. You need to cut the apron strings. I said, how am I going to cut my apron strings when Derek cannot walk, talk, or do anything on his own? See, that's where you're wrong. Derek can
do it. The black man sticks his arm out the car window.
You're opening up a whole new world for him.
The black man's hand basks in the sunlight. The two women in front sit quietly. John.
The ways in which she talked to my mom, you know, not mothering the proper way and saying that Derek doesn't like this and wants this, or Daisy, you need to let him be a man, it just kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Part of it might just be a level of self-consciousness on my part, because I remember growing up in the late 80s, early 90s, and, you know, when my mom and dad separated and then divorced, the idea of single parenthood was resonant.
News articles on black families without fathers.
There was all these studies about, you know, children of single parent households just don't do well, and, you know, invariably it was framed around, you know, black women aren't good parents. You know, there's things that black women can't teach their sons, and all of that was kind of in my ears. Now, I think it's important to recognize that my mom, prior to all of this, was affiliated with a number of organizations that were headed by women of color who were advocates for people of color with disabilities who otherwise may have been overlooked. For Anna to make certain assumptions about my mom's expertise or her decision-making and those kinds of things, it just has those racial undertones and overtones. It wasn't like, you know, nigga getting the back of the bus kind of racism. It wasn't that, but it was more like making assumptions based on the idea that certain people might be inherently deficient.
A framed photo on the wall.
Anna was just ignoring the past 30 some odd years and everything that my mom has done to get us to this point. Right?
Derek pushes Daisy in a wheelchair. She carries keys in her mouth.
So I had it in my mind, we're going to have a long conversation. We are going to have to like really set some hard, fast rules, or we may have to just kind of begin to draw things down.
A photo of Anna and Derek sitting together and looking at the Neo. Anna.
Demand and I had debated on several occasions whether we wanted to say anything to Daisy and John about the change in our relationship. We knew we were going to tell them eventually, so it was more just we were enjoying that kind of initial beginning of a romance when it's very private and it's very intimate and it's just the two of you, and it changes when you start sharing with family. But we had started figuring out ways that we could, you know, try to spend time together. And it was a Sunday. Demand and I had made plans to go to a film festival in New York where there was a film being shown called Wretches and Jabberers, which is about FC users. Daisy wanted to go to church that morning. And in thinking about locations and stuff for eventual romantic rendezvous, we definitely didn't want to use, you know, his mother's house. But, you know, here we are at the house and she's not there. And it's difficult for him to kiss. So we wanted to practice. Like anything else, it was a physical challenge for him.
An empty dining room.
I could tell that, you know, he's very tense. And every time he tried to sit back, he would kind of pop up again. And I said, like, talk to me. You know, obviously, this is not working for you. What's going on? And he typed, I really, really love being with you, and I want to be doing this, but I'm just really overwhelmed right now. I need a minute. And I said, you know, fine, take all the time you need, of course. So he scooted himself down the hallway, and I got a glass of water. I was just giving him some time. And I said to him, look, you know, you're the one where this is all a brand new thing for you. You've got to call the shots. You've got to, you know, I don't want to do anything that makes you uncomfortable. I don't want to push anything faster. I don't know what's going to work for your body and what isn't. So you tell me. I was figuring at that point that, like, the moment had passed and that was all right. And he typed, may I touch your breasts? And I was like, wow, okay, I didn't know where that was, you know, that wasn't what I was expecting. Okay. And then he typed, take your shirt off all the way. I was like, okay. So I did that. And then he said, take the rest of your clothes off. And okay, so I did. And then he said, you know, I've dreamed about this. It seemed to me that what he was doing was taking control of the situation. He was like really ordering me around, and, you know, but that was kind of cool because I wasn't necessarily anticipating that element of the relationship. You know, he said, I long to hold you the way that men do. I said to him, look, I feel held. He said, do you think that it would even be possible with my cerebral palsy for us to make love? And I said, you know, I have no idea, but there's only one way to find out.
Tree branches sway as a strong breeze blows through them. An overhead view of a residential street. Text, Memorial Day 2011. A car pulls up to a curb. The white woman gets out and walks over to the house in front of her car. She rings the doorbell. Anna.
We had this meeting scheduled for Memorial Day for Demand to talk to Daisy and John about the independent living counselor. And Demand brought up, or I brought up, I don't even remember, you know, should we also use this opportunity to tell them about the change in our relationship? But I said to him, look, if Daisy and John did get upset about this and chose to separate us, technically that's a violation of your rights, but it would be very hard to challenge them on that. He said to me, they would never do that to me. They love me too much.
John talks to us.
We all sit down, and there just seemed to be this awkwardness about it. You know, if we're going to talk about business, let's talk business. But she looked at Derek and said, "Do you want me to tell them?" And so, tell us what? And then she grabs Derek's hand, and on the keyboard comes up, "We are in love."
The woman talks to the family living in the house.
So he typed, "Anna and I are in love. And, we have a physical relationship." I think John said something about, to use protection, and Demand said yes. And
she said, "Yes, we have made love."
Daisy pauses. Her eyes widen in disbelief, and she frowns.
And I was like, "What? Yes, we've made love. He's a man in every sense of the word." And what I did, I sat on my hands. And I said, "You did what?"
The woman continues talking to the family. Anna.
They asked me about where things were at with my husband. And, I told them I really did want to, be with Demand permanently to marry him. That I hadn't talked to my husband yet, but that I was going to very soon. And there was a moment as part of the conversation where he asked me to kiss him. I found that a little awkward. Like, I didn't really want to in that moment. Just like, but he insisted, so I did.
Daisy talks to us.
I tried to be civil. John had gone somewhere, and I think he went down and threw up.
I was shocked. I didn't really know what to make of it at the time, but I felt myself getting so angry and rage-filled that I left. I went downstairs, I paced the floor a bunch of times, I looked at the cracks in the wall, I remember. I had to let my anger subside.
I said goodbye to Demand, and Daisy was there, and she came and gave me a big hug and said, we'll get through this. We'll figure this out. I was heading out the door and just saying goodbye to Demand. I said to him, good call, love, fun. It was a good choice to tell them. And then I left, and, I was feeling fine.
The white woman leaves the house, a neat row of two-story homes in a tree-lined street.
John called me the next morning, about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I think I knew something was going to be wrong when I saw he was calling. He said, "Daisy and I don't want you to see Demand until you and she and I have a chance to sit down and talk." We sort of scheduled a meeting, then she pulled out, then John or Daisy got back to me and said, we just don't want to meet. That was when then I started calling Daisy.
"Hey, Daisy, it's Anna. Calling to find out if things are going to work out. I'm hoping for us to get together tomorrow."
She would talk to me on the phone. I would kind of address her concerns and talk about things.
"Daisy, this is Anna. I've been thinking about concerns that you raised the last time that we talked. And I'll put in writing with my finger and sign with blood that I will commit to a specific time when I will leave my husband and I will make a permanent life and home with the man. Okay?
And then she stopped returning my calls.
She left this message, "I will sign my name in blood so I can be with Derek." And at that point, I was just like, "Oh, this is off the chain. Something's wrong here." Mm-hmm. At that point, I guess the academic side of me just started focusing in on facilitated communication. I had a number of questions. I had a number of red flags.
The white woman helps the black man next to her type something on a keyboard.
One of the things that happened with the facilitated communication was that part of the sessions were for us, my mom and I, to also practice with him. And so I would be there with him, and, a sentence will come out. "All right, John, you try." And so I would try to, and I would get nothing. Eventually he would apply pressure. I may get two words, but it wouldn't make sense. And then when my mama tried, nothing would happen.
"See all these marks on my arm? That was Derek's facilitating. He would grab me and pull my hand, you know, take my hand away from his.
The coaching from Anna was, you have to keep trying, you have to keep practicing, you have to anticipate what he's going to say. That was one of those, like, That's when I guess my own doubts started to creep in, and that's when I started looking for the video that I initially saw in the classroom to see what in the world am I doing wrong? And that's when I stumbled upon the Frontline documentary on FC.
Archive footage of an old Frontline episode.
Some people had their doubts about facilitated communication. Dr. Howard Shane has devoted his life to helping disabled, nonverbal people to communicate.
This is Dr. Shane.
How are you?
Nice to meet you.
Howard Shane.
In 1990, I got a call from a prosecutor in Western Massachusetts because someone was being facilitated, and while being facilitated, he mentioned that his aide in his group residence was sexually abusing him. And the prosecutor wanted to be sure that this individual was actually independently communicating. When you have somebody hold your hand, it obviously brings up the question every time, well, are they being influenced? How can you be sure that these individuals are actually, you know, independently communicating, or they aren't being facilitated and really being
an article excerpt. Sexual abuse allegations are absolutely rampant, says autism expert Green, who's tracked 17 cases.
I went on to design a protocol that would enable me to determine who was authoring the message.
Okay, folks, what I'm going to be doing now...
Shane had devised a double-blind test like this. He showed both a series of pictures and asked them to type what they saw. Okay.
Betsy, I'm sure you're looking at...
When both Betsy and her facilitator saw a picture of a key, the letters K-E-Y were typed. But Shane wanted to discover what happened if each saw a different picture.
Okay.
When Betsy saw a cup, she didn't type cup, she typed hat, what the facilitator saw.
I'll take a look at this one. Okay.
When Betsy was shown a picture of a dog, she didn't type dog, but sneakers, what the facilitator saw.
Okay, here's the next one.
Later work that I did and others have done seems to indicate that facilitators were doing this, thinking that they were giving people the ability to be able to communicate. I don't think that they're intentionally trying to create a false message. They believe that this is coming from the person who's being facilitated.
The scientific evidence suggested that far from unlocking the minds of autistic individuals, FC tapped the unconscious thoughts of the facilitator.
John talks to us.
I just remember thinking at the time, you know, Derek was writing those papers. What I found interesting in hindsight is that a lot of it revolved around this idea of, you know, now I have a voice. Now I can speak and talk. And whereas I was trapped, now I have this freedom. And a lot of it revolved around things that just, in my estimation, were not about Derek. And so to me, it was just like, this whole FC thing is bogus.
Anna.
I never got any vibe off of John or Daisy that they didn't 100% believe that what Demand said was Demand's words. I had been careful in the beginning to make sure that I wasn't influencing him. But there were so many situations that he was telling me information I didn't know. And in the beginning, I was checking it to make sure that I wasn't influencing. And the fact that we had arguments and disagreements and so on and so forth, I mean, he very clearly had his own mind. He more than proved himself. The homework assignments that Demand had typed with Sharonda and she hadn't read the books. I mean, had John come and talked to me, I had all of this proof that I could have shared with him to reassure him.
A clip of a young man typing on a communication board, Deva.
I have
seen facilitated communication absolutely work. I can't say it's a universally applicable technique, but who can, for anything?
I can't say
universally applicable. But who can?
The white woman strides along in a hallway. Detective.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Facilitated communication. The individual, what he does is that he points to the letters or types them with the assistance of someone else.
Yeah, the key there is to, one, make sure that the facilitator, the person holding the hand, is not unintentionally trying to spell things out themselves or guessing or assuming what it is the person is saying.
So it's safe to say that it's a thin line. I mean, it's hard to say.
John talks to us.
At the time, we weren't trying to pursue any kind of legal thing. We just wanted to leave us alone. But then one day, the director of Derek's day program got an email from Anna, and the gist of it was, Daisy and John have not allowed me to see Derek, but Daisy and John don't know what's in Derek's best interest, but we as people who work with people with disabilities do.
An excerpt from Anna's email to Nicole Ballard reads, I'm wondering if you'd be okay with me just quietly seeing him one more time, just for an afternoon like we used to do?
And at that point, I saw, well, you know what, if she's going to go to these lengths to try to get to Derek behind our back, there's no telling what she may do. And I need to take steps necessary to put an end to this. And so I made an appointment to meet with the dean. I remember going into her office, and I started to tell her what was going on. She kind of froze and was like, took a deep breath and was somewhat in disbelief. I don't think I had taken opportunity to kind of let myself release this emotion. I was just sat in that office, and I don't think I ever cried in front of a white woman before, but I just broke down. And she basically said to me in so many words, John, make sure you get a lawyer.
Fade out.
Hello?
Hello, Anna?
Hi.
Hi, how you doing?
What's up?
I want to talk to you about Derek. There's been some things that's been bothering me about our last conversation.
I got a phone call one day from Daisy, and she said,
he has not been acting himself, and I think he misses you.
Miss him.
She said, you know, he's been biting his hand a lot more. He's really unhappy. So she said, I'm just trying to understand what happened between the two of you.
He's been mouthing his hands and doing all sorts of things. So, you know, I need to know how many times you all made love, Emma. I really, because I'm thinking about what's really going on with Sarah and how he's feeling.
To me, it sounded like, oh, maybe this is an opening. You know, maybe they're seeing he's unhappy and they're reconsidering. And so I was happy to answer her questions.
In terms of actually making love, there were two Sundays that we were able to be together like that.
So what did you do? What, I mean, please clear this up in my head for me.
Well, I mean, my office has enough floor space, and I brought in an exercise mat and the beach towel, and we were able to make things work.
You know, again, that feels kind of weird to talk about with your lover's mother, but, you know, whatever. If it kept the conversation going and if she was listening.
She's the most important person in my life. I'm the most important person in his life. We're so happy when we're together. I'm lucky if I get through 20 minutes of any day without thinking about him. If I did things like bite my hands, I'd be biting my hands right now too.
I found out later that phone call had been set up by the police and they had coached her on what to say and it was being recorded.
Detective Carlos Omo.
The date is August 22nd, 2011. This is regarding Special Victims Unit case number S11-0141. The target of the investigation is one Marjorie Ann Stubblefield. The consenting party is a one Daisy P. Johnson. The crimes investigated are crimes of the sexual assault nature.
Detective Carlos Olmo's telephone intercept transcript appears on screen. Anna talks to us.
It was a Monday, and I was teaching class in the afternoon, so I pulled into the parking lot, and I was approached by two people in plain clothes. And they said, we're with the Essex County Prosecutor's Office, and we need to ask you some questions. And the only thing I could think of was something about a student. You know, I'm wondering what's going on. And then they said, do you know somebody named Derek Johnson? I was like, okay. You know, and that was already starting to penetrate that, wow, okay, this is... So then I had to make a decision on the spot about how much do I say? But I figured, you know what, I didn't do anything wrong. I talked to them for about 2 hours, and I told them the whole story. You know, that we were in love and all of that stuff. I just didn't actually say the words. You know, we consummated the relationship. They drove me back to the parking lot at Rutgers, and there was a person I didn't know who identified himself as a representative of the dean's office. He handed me a letter, and the letter informed me that as of this moment, I was suspended from my teaching duties at Rutgers. I was not allowed on campus.
Highlighted text from the letter reads, "The university is in receipt of information to the effect that you have engaged in sexual activity with one Derek Johnson. It is particularly troubling that you did this while in a position of superior authority. File photos of Anna's house."
And while I was there, they had gone to my house with a search warrant.
Forensic photos of a tote bag and a communication board flash on screen.
My now ex-husband was there, so he's found out that I'm under investigation.
Forensic photos of Anna's office flash on screen. The signpost on her door shows a silhouette of a woman rock climbing. One photo shows her desk with a book and documents strewn all over it. Now witness interview transcripts appear on screen.
This is Detective Christine Mikowski of the Essex County Prosecutor's Office. I am interviewing Ms. Sharonda Jones. Ms. Jones, did there ever come a time that you got involved with Anna Stubblefield?
Yes. My professor suggested her because I work with children with mental and behavioral disorders. So she figured that it would probably be a good connection because she talked about working with facilitated communication.
Can you tell me a little bit about the facilitated communication? What kind of process is that?
It's pretty much me being an arm for the man. I would hold his arm up while he would type out whatever thoughts that he had on a communication board. He pretty much read the books. I didn't know any information about the book. I can't tell you what he read, and he typed out the information. One of my roommates was in the class with him, and they pretty much wrote some of the same things.
Today we're conducting an interview with Ms. Karen Moore. And what do you do at the university?
I teach African American literature.
And how do you know Ms. Stubblefield?
Well, she wrote to me. He was not in my class last semester, so it must have been 2010.
And when you say he, that's Derek Johnson?
I only knew him as D-Man. I did not know that was his name.
And Anna would assist with...
Well, you know what that situation is. They say that, you know, the students are saying what they want to say while she's guiding the hand, so...
Did he participate in the class?
He did. He, I guess, would... I don't know that I really believe that that actually happens, but...
So...
So she would, you know, write whatever it was that he wanted to say. She'd raise her hand and she'd read it.
He would never have verbalized anything,
or... As far as I know, he can't talk.
Okay. Yeah.
The early morning sun casts a light yellow shade on a thick cluster of trees surrounding a lake. Mist rises from the water. Howard Shane, who has thick gray hair, is on a rowboat. His upper torso rhythmically moves backward and forward as he maneuvers the oars. Howard.
I got a call from my assistant saying that the special victims unit in New Jersey was calling. Asked me if I would be willing to provide some assistance as an expert.
Now inside his house, Howard sits at his desk and browses his computer.
as it was described to me, I'd never encountered any case that mirrored these particular circumstances. I had never seen anything like it.
A commercial jet lands on an airport runway. Text, June 2012.
In this case, the question to me was, could you evaluate Derek to understand his best level of communication? From everything that I read, there was a consistency to the extent of his disability. But I went in with an open mind. I met him when he was brought to the prosecutor's office. He was accompanied by his brother and his mother. I already knew that he had no speech. So I proceeded to introduce different types of materials for him to indicate, pictures, photographs, which are very realistic. It was difficult for him. You know, I really didn't get very much from that. He was able to pick up some objects, but not when I said, you know, pick up the spoon or pick up the cup. I did an interview of his mother based on everything that she had observed, and she certainly was a very good observer. I found that he was, you know, functioning at a pretty low level. His way of telling you that he wanted something to eat was he would scoot over to the refrigerator and tap on the refrigerator. That's very functional. But to move from that to pointing to a picture of the refrigerator, that's a greater level of abstraction. And in all the years he had been in these different programs, he had never moved from the physical to that type of communication. I spent 2 or 3 hours with him. He spent a lot of time just moving around the room. He liked coat hangers. So if he saw a coat hanger, he would go over and he recognized that. He liked to slap him on the floor.
A gray-haired man vigorously writes in his notebook. Howard.
So I just basically reported what I found.
Excerpts from Howard's notes read, his expressive and receptive language is somewhere in the 6 to 12 month range. He's not able to use a communication device of any kind. He has the physical ability to be able to use one. He just does not have the intellectual ability to use one.
I made a determination that what I was observing was consistent with what the medical record had indicated for, you know, over 20 years of his life. There was no one in the 20 years who saw some sparkling of, you know, something different.
More excerpts read, Derek evidences deficits in all areas of functioning. Communication consists of infantile sounds. Derek was diagnosed as severely mentally retarded. Anna's mugshot appears on screen, followed by a headline that reads, Rutgers Newark professor charged with sexual assault of disabled man.
Like a call.
Deva, I got the call that Anna had been arrested, and I went, all right. So I flew out and I attended the trial. This case is about three things, communication, race, and it's about sex. And those three things got incredibly muddy. On the personal level, it's about control, and it's about guilt.
This case is about three things. Communication, race, and it's about sex. And those three things got incredibly muddy. On the personal level, it's about control and it's about guilt.
She smiles sadly. Fade out. Text. Chapter 3. Guilt. A Lady Justice statue stands in front of a courthouse building with tall glass panels. Text. September 2015. Sandy talks to us.
I was actually looking forward to the trial as finally this nightmare is going to be over. I knew she was not guilty of anything.
An elevator door opens to an empty hallway that leads to a courtroom. Anna.
I'm not guilty of what they were accusing me of. If the accusation is I have some weird perversion that makes me want to molest helpless, intellectually impaired people. That's simply not the case. This whole thing is
framed in terms of consent and his ability to consent because I'm the one who's accused of assault. It's all as if it was all coming from me, which is really not fair to him because he seduced me and he deserves some credit for that. Here's this guy who's so physically impaired and he got me to fall in love with him and with his words.
Text. The court determined that facilitated communication did not meet the standards of admissible evidence. No testimony related to FC or any documentation from the NEO could be used by Anna's defense.
The judge kept taking things away and taking things away in terms of evidence. I knew that DeMann was the author of what he typed. I wasn't influencing him. But at the end of the day, I didn't have anything except my word for that.
Photos from the trial appear on screen, including of the judge, a middle-aged black woman wearing glasses.
There was a morning the prosecutor said, we're going to bring DeMann into the courtroom. It was Daisy who walked him in.
I had to say who he was. And, you know, I was his mother. And the fact that he could not walk by himself independently, I just walked him in front of the judge and then around by the jury stand.
Sandy.
It was horrifying to me that a human being had been basically made an exhibit. I know with DeMann there are ways of walking with him in which he looks less handicapped, and his mother walked him in a way that made him look as handicapped and incapable as one could possibly manage.
She turned around again, and she turned always putting her body in between him and me and walked him out.
Deva. I think that for some jurors, the trial was over when they saw Derek paraded through the courtroom. I think that everyone in that room, all the women, immediately wanted to protect him. The idea that Anna would have any normal adult pleasure from having a lover like Derek was inconceivable.
And I think that if you want him in that room, of women,
Various courtroom sketches flash on screen. Anna talks to us.
What we didn't have on the jury was anyone with significant physical disabilities or, you know, that understanding of a disability rights perspective on the whole case. At the end of the day, it was just be myself and tell my story, and hopefully the jury would see that guy over there is this wonderful, intelligent man who I was in love with.
Text. Question. At the time you entered into this relationship, did you have a conclusion as to whether or not you believed he was capable of consent? Anna replies.
I wouldn't have fallen in love with him if he was somebody that wasn't capable of consent. I wouldn't have fallen in love with him if he wasn't interested in reading books and talking about ideas. If somebody has an interesting, engaging mind and a good heart and a beautiful soul, it shows through and you love the person, and so you love being close to them and you love the body that they're in because that's the body that they have.
An empty courtroom seen from various angles. The room has dark paneled walls and fluorescent lighting. A microphone sits on the ledge of the jury stand lined with two rows of black chairs. An American flag stands in the corner beside the stand. Now Anna answers a question asked by a man off camera.
Was there any moment, either during your time with Derek, or during the trial, or now, where you had doubts about what might have occurred between you two?
Never.
Anna shakes her head with conviction. The sun's rays filter through a tree's leafy branches. Behind it stands a gray rectangular building. A courtroom sketch of Daisy and the judge presiding over Anna's case appears on screen. Now Daisy talks to us.
Her attorney came and he was making me to be the villain.
And he said, well, how do you feel about her being his lover? I said, no. I said, she's not his lover. This whore done laid down, raped my son, and I had to compose myself. Because
she pauses, points her index finger up, shuts her eyes, and shakes her head.
That's my son. Days and nights I walked through hospital corridors, not knowing what was wrong with my son, not knowing his medical condition, him having seizures. And for that moment, I almost lost it. I did. I really did.
Her eyes well up.
Because who does that? Who does that? And then go criticize me. Make me look like I'm nobody. I don't understand. Who does that?
Daisy purses her lips and wears a sad expression on her face. John talks to us.
I don't think that Anna Stubblefield truly recognized how she devalued my brother and also devalued my family. It's one thing to hear Anna Stubblefield say, Derek and I love each other. Just like... But as the details of what actually transpired unfold, that she was in her office, she had this mat on the floor. And then you recall that moment or that day where I was changing Derek's diaper and I saw these abrasions on his back. Strawberries, like somebody's dragging you across the floor. And we couldn't figure out where the heck these things came from. We called the school. Did Derek fall down? Did something happen at the school? Did somebody hit my brother? They're like, no, there's no, nothing happened. We don't know. Prosecutor's trying to figure out what happened, and the story comes out, oh, something happened in the office. And, I mean, this woman, 140, 150 pounds, I don't know how much she weighed, but she's much heavier than him. Derek is slight. He's 5'3", 5'4". And she was exerting so much force on him that his back was being drug across this mat, and it was leaving scars.
John furrows his eyebrows. An anguished expression clouds his face. He shakes his head, fighting back tears. He then lets off a bitter chuckle and purses his lips. He shifts on his seat and crumples his face.
That woman did not give a damn about my brother.
Black and white photos of the day of Anna's conviction. She appears stoic in some of them, but one photo shows her wearing a pained expression while handcuffed. Anna talks to us.
I didn't think I was going to be convicted, but I wear contacts. And that morning when the jury came back, I did put my glasses in my purse. It was my one little concession to, if I ended up in prison, I needed my glasses.
Sandy.
I think by the time the verdict actually came, I was expecting it.
When the jury read the conviction, I started saying out loud to the judge, just, you know, please let me take care of my daughter. You know, just please let me take care of my daughter.
Deva, Anna was a little bit naive, but that's her. Could she have played her role better? Sure. But I think whatever went on in private, she absolutely believed it was consensual.
But I think whatever went on in private, she absolutely believed what she said.
Sandy.
Never doubted her. Not for an instant. I mean, I watched her interact with people her whole life. And she is as compassionate a person as I've ever known. And there's no way, I mean, she's never harmed anybody. And there's certainly no way she would have harmed a man.
Do you think she believed that he was typing?
Yeah, in her wicked mind. In her wicked mind.
Daytime, a view of a cityscape. Text, January 15th, 2016, sentencing hearing. Anna is escorted by a male guard into a courtroom. She wears her glasses and a pink prison jumpsuit.
State versus Marjorie Anna Stubblefield, indictment number 13-1-44. We are here today for the sentencing of Marjorie Anna Stubblefield. Is there anyone that would like to speak on behalf of the state?
Yes, Your Honor. The victim's brother, John Johnson, would like to address the court. His mother would like to approach and stand with him while he addresses the court.
That's fine.
John, in a black suit, comes forward while Anna sits nearby, flanked by her legal counsel.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Good afternoon.
34 years ago, doctors said my brother would not live to see his third birthday. Those doctors and the devil are liars. My brother since then has grown to become a loving person. He is a beautiful brother, and he is a beautiful son. I don't think Anna understood the depth of pain she caused my family. She tried to lay claim to him and rename him. She tried to supplant Derek's life, a life steeped. A life steeped in the history and culture of his God-fearing, Southern-rooted, African-American family. She tried to supplant that with some version of life she thought was better. We need to disenchant ourselves from the notion that Anna Stubblefield is some tragic she-ro. Anna is not Sandra Bullock, and this is not The Blind Side. Derek is not some poor black kid from the ghetto that needs someone to save him. An able-bodied woman raped a disabled young man that could not consent to sex. You were wrong, Anna. You committed a crime. There is no gray area. In closing, thank Your Honor for helping bring this ordeal to a close.
Anna remains quiet, but keeps her gaze fixed on John. The judge, a middle-aged black woman, picks up a document.
I have read and received letters from the former husband of the defendant who wrote a very compelling impact statement. I believe that Anna is a pathological liar and narcissist. She will stop at nothing to fool the court and seek vindication regardless of the emotional and financial expense to her family or the primary victim's family. Clearly, I am distraught, but this and the impact on my immediate family, I leave it to the wisdom of the court to determine a just sentence.
Anna sits in silence, looking pensive.
Ms. Stubblefield, please stand.
She gets up and faces the judge.
As to count one, first-degree aggravated sexual assault where the victim was physically helpless or mentally incapacitated, I sentence you to 12 years in New Jersey State Prison. As to count two, I sentence you to 12 years New Jersey State Prison concurrent with count one. After you are released from prison, you are placed on parole supervision for life.
A handcuffed Anna turns to the public gallery behind her and gives her mother a soft smile. Sandy smiles back. She is then escorted out of the courtroom by two male bailiffs. She grins sheepishly as she heads for the exit. On another day, a truck drives past a heavily fenced building surrounded by bare trees. Text, Edna Mahan Correctional Facility for Women, Clinton, New Jersey. Howard talks to us.
I never thought that she was a predator. She truly believed that what she was doing was in Derek's best interest. She thought that he deserves the opportunity to have a life outside of, you know, living with his mother. But I think that given what I observed and what I learned from his record, I think that it would have been a false life with Anna. I think that she was an unfortunate victim of methodology that's very problematic. However she interpreted what was going on, whether she actually had those conversations with him, I don't know. But she, you know, from my perspective, she was having conversations with herself. I don't know where to even go with it.
Inside a prison, a brightly lit hall is lined by solid doors on each side. A dreary, empty cell is furnished with a steel bedstead and a welded stainless steel toilet. Elsewhere inside a room, the white woman helps a black man use a communication keyboard. Fade out. Text. 2 years later, Anna steps out of her single-story home. She collects her trash can from the curb and rolls it to the side of her house. Text. Anna appealed her conviction, and a three-judge panel decided in her favor. They ruled that Anna's defense was limited by the court's dismissal of testimony related to facilitated communication. Having served 2 years of her sentence, she accepted a plea to a lesser charge and was released. Now Anna enters her house. She walks along a corridor leading to a room lined with shelves stacked with books and framed photos. She sits at a table and works on her computer. Anna talks to us.
When I first came out of prison, I managed to pick up a waitressing job. And then there was some publicity around when I did the plea bargain and I was sentenced, and one of their customers complained, and so they let me go. So I was doing that kind of thing for the first year. And then I do have, you know, what's now kind of part-time work. I'm working at home. Nobody knows me. And so, you know, that's okay. But it's, you know, it's not teaching. That was my whole identity. That was everything.
Inside her kitchen, she prepares a meal. She chops some tomatoes on a wooden board.
I don't know what DeMann's life is like now. As far as his mother and brother, I think they had to really decide that he wasn't intelligent and he wasn't typing and it was all a fraud and a hoax. A friend of mine who is somebody else who uses facilitated communication, who knew DeMann and was friends with DeMann, and he said, look, if I was DeMann, I would rather have, you know, had the relationship with you and lost it than never to have had it in the first place. So I hope that he's right, you know, but.
She falls quiet. A wistful expression appears on her face. Elsewhere, trees beside a row of houses sway gently in the wind. Daisy talks to us.
People don't think that there was damage done. Yes, it was. And it's still going on. I had to put him on medication because he masturbates. He has this urge, and you know, it's like an itch that he can't scratch. And it's hard enough to give him a life without him going through that. And she did that. Because if you don't ever strike that match or do whatever, how will you ever know?
Inside Derek's room, John helps his brother put on his shirt.
Showing all your muscles, huh? You good? Ready to eat?
John.
One of the tough things about this whole process is that there was this idea that, oh, he can do all these wonderful things. And then to have to, looking at everything that was taking place, then say, but he can't.
Daisy has a tender expression on her face as she watches John helping Derek walk.
And in a sense, I kind of felt as though I was diminishing his value. Yeah, Derek can't do that. Going through that process of having to recognize that, damn, yeah, he is really disabled. And that's fine. He can't do all the other things that other people can do, and that's perfectly fine because we're going to be all right regardless.
Okay. Oh, you can show him that smile? Yeah, so here I am. The psychiatrist determined that Derek was deemed incapable and incompetent of taking care of himself. Well, I knew. And knowing and accepting it and just embrace him, just love him for who he is. No matter what or how strong he gets, he's still my child. He will always have that younger mindset. And I, you know, he's 40 years old. And that's where we are.
Now the Johnsons are outside on their porch. Daisy and John chat as Derek sits across from them. John gently rubs Derek's back.
And I don't love him no less, and I don't love him no more. He's my baby. He is my baby.
She smiles warmly. Now, Daisy and Derek step outside their house, but Daisy heads back indoors, leaving Derek standing alone outside. He grips the railings on either side. He remains quiet, swaying his head from side to side. Fade out. Text. The use of facilitated communication has been rejected by the American Psychological Association, the American Speech-Language Hearing Association, and several other prominent organizations. It is still practiced in some institutions and by people across the world who insist it is a vital means for some nonverbal people to communicate. Fade out. Credits roll. Produced and directed by Nick August Perna. Editor, Seth Balms. Executive producers, Aaron Fellows, Louis Thoreau. Executive producer for Sky, Haley Reynolds. Executive producers for Topic, Ryan Chanatree, Mahalia Cohen. Archival, Boston Globe 1993. Boston Globe Media Partners, CNN, Dreamstime, eFootage, GBH Archives, John Wiley & Sons, John O. Ratman, Mike McCormick, Pond 5, Syracuse University Libraries, The Age, The Philadelphia Inquirer 1984, Philadelphia Inquirer LLC, Tim Chan, University Archives, Special Collections Research Center, Syracuse University Libraries, Albert Carbon Neutral Sustainable Production, a Mindhouse production, Sky UK Limited 2023. Logos, Mindhouse, Sky Studios.